May it please the Court. The issue before the Court today is whether this Court will adhere to the standards that set forth in Ross or will actually adopt the dissenting view from Ross. And there are good reasons why this Court should adhere to Ross. It has served this Court and its court system well for more than 20 years. And that standard that is applied in Ross is whether there's an appearance of impropriety in situations where an attorney changes sides from the defense side and goes to a prosecutor's office. That standard from Ross has important values, which is confidence in the integrity of the system. It's just as important that the system appear to be fair as it actually is fair. Those considerations go hand in hand. In this situation, we have an attorney who engaged in much work in preparation. The amount of time is really not what's critical here. It's the kind of preparation that she did. She did an initial letter to the client advising him of the kinds of matters that ought to be taken into account to start off the case. She entered her appearance. She assigned a paralegal to do certain investigation. In the context of assigning that paralegal to do investigation, made really disparaging remarks about the client's family and also commented on how those remarks should be viewed and conveyed to the family if not conveyed.
Is there anything to indicate that she had much substantive communication with the client?
She met with him and discussed issues going to his health concerns. And at trial, his health concerns were a big issue. They were made a big issue. His long-term heart condition was made a big issue by both parties. The prosecutor, in his questioning of the ex-wife, who was one of the principal witnesses, gave great attention to what this heart condition was. And in the defense case, when Mr. LeMasters was called as a witness, the defense counsel also gave great attention to that because he felt as though it would portray Mr. LeMasters in a favorable light, whereas the state tried to present him in an unfavorable light, that he was just sort of this lazy person who committed these acts involving his daughter. And in closing argument, the state focused on judge the credibility of his ex-wife, his daughter, who the acts were alleged to have been committed against, and Mr. LeMasters. And the state significantly and substantially devoted its cross of Mr. LeMasters to issues about his health concerns and his long-term health issues.
I mean, because the question is, when there is the appearance of impropriety, isn't it that not just that there was some contact, but it's the nature of the representation, and isn't it that there would be some compromising of the client's position by counsel switching to the other side, as opposed to just a lack of loyalty or something. And so, is there some indication that she was in a position she could have compromised that, or am I reading more into what the prior cases say the test should be?
Judge, I think for a defendant and also for the public, there's that perception. Now, I know there's evidence in the record that the attorney testified that she was screened, and she didn't convey those things to her new employer, but that's not what the concern is.
But there was evidence that she had a paralegal or investigator go talk because she couldn't really figure out what he was telling her because of the use of pronouns and things like that. So that doesn't indicate that there was a significant communication during that 15-minute period.
Well, I mean, I think there was significant communication when she acknowledged having met with the client and discussed things such as his health issues. And there's a letter that's part of the exhibit from his mother that the attorney in question acknowledged she had read, and it discusses in some detail those kinds of concerns. So in addition to directing the paralegal investigator to do certain acts, she indicated that she was asking them to do that in order to basically get at the relevant facts of the case, and asking that paralegal investigator to get at the relevant facts of the case because she was unclear as to what they were really shows a significant commitment on her part to getting to preparing a defense. Now, she testified she didn't have a theory of defense, but she was very much engaged in the process of preparing that defense.
What,
even though the amount of time she was on the case was about approximately a month.
What about the fact that, you know, the rule changed after some of those prior cases, and that lawyers ought to be able to rely on that if they satisfy the ethical rules, that it won't affect their later employment, which is different than, you know, in the judge context. In addition to the judicial canon of ethics, we also have procedural rules regarding disqualification or recusal. But it's a different situation, it seems to me, we're talking about a lawyer.
Judge, I think there is the idea that lawyers can move to different employment, and I think that's what you're getting at. Mm-hmm. But I think the values, and specifically this court talked about in Rost, the quasi-judicial function of a prosecutor, which is not only to represent the state, but to assume the process that a judge does in ensuring that there's a fair trial.
Well, and maybe that's true if the person's actually involved in the process. This is not talking about a concurrent situation, but it's talking about really a prior conflict, right?
Judge, I think what the Southern District said was that this was, you know, what happened in Ross was concurrent representation. Mm-hmm. But this court didn't look at whether it was concurrent. This court looked at all the facts that would suggest to a person in the position of Ross to question the fairness of the proceedings. So I don't think concurrent representation is the issue at all. It's the entire package that we have here of all the facts that are going on in terms of what is done by the attorney. And also, I think when you look at the disparaging kinds of comments that are made about the family and the merits of the case, it would cause both Mr. LeMasters and the public at large to question whether the process is fair.
Is there a difference? I mean, one way the question is presented in the party's briefs is, should appearance of impropriety be a basis for disqualification of the prosecutor's office? But another way to look at it is, what is an appearance of impropriety? And is it automatically an appearance of impropriety that someone who was formerly representing the defendant went to a prosecutor's office with a Chinese wall, and is it an appearance of impropriety that then someone else in that office handled the case? We have to look at it as accepting Ross or rejecting Ross, or looking at the rule change and does it apply or not apply, or is it simply a question of, is this a case in which there's an appearance of impropriety? Or do we have to hold that it's always an appearance of impropriety if you represented someone and gained some personal knowledge?
I think, Judge, that what we're getting at here is Ross set the standard that it was an appearance of impropriety.
But that begs the question, what is an appearance of impropriety?
I think it's engaging in meaningful representation of the client, which means communicating with the interviewer.
And I'm asking you, why is that? Some of the questions go to it, that may be it, but to the extent the questions say, but this person didn't, there's no suggestion they passed on information, there was a Chinese wall, they got substantive information, but it was relatively minimal. People always transfer from public defenders to prosecutors and back and forth, and that's common. Does that go into deciding whether, in fact, there is an appearance of impropriety in this kind of transfer?
I mean, I think all the facts that are at play here go into deciding whether there was an appearance of impropriety. And I don't think you isolate on one particular one. I think, like we do in the judge disqualification context, we look at all the facts that are in the record. I would disagree that this happens frequently because, I mean, Ross was decided 22 years ago. We've only had two other cases that have reached the state. There was Reinschmidt and then the Horn versus Ray case where this has come up. So this is not, I think it's greatly been overstated by the state that this is imposing a great burden on them. And really all it really limits in terms of prosecutors is going to the same office that you oppose on an everyday basis. You know, this attorney could have gone to the Greene County Prosecutor's Office and this problem wouldn't have even arisen. It's because she went to whether it's down the hallway or across the street, the same office that she was working for. And I think that's the critical fact.
How far is the next prosecutor's office in next county from Newton?
I don't know. In terms of miles, Judge, I don't think it's particularly far. This is all Southwest Missouri. She could have applied for a prosecutor's position in
No. I mean, she keeps the position in Newton, but the prosecution goes to another county.
I'm sorry, I'm not following.
I'm not saying she should change jobs. I'm just saying to disqualify the Newton prosecutor because she's in the Newton prosecuting office and send it to another prosecutor's office.
And that would be easily accomplished. It could have been
easily. How are those kinds of things compensated?
How are they compensated?
And you're suggesting it's no burden. To appoint as a special prosecutor the next county auditor, do they have to willingly consent to serve? Is there a special county appropriation for special prosecutor? How are you suggesting that be handled?
There's a statute actually, you know, authorizes the Attorney General's office to be involved. So I think that's an option there. Getting back to what Your Honor raised about in terms of the change in the rules, well, the rules had changed when Ross had been decided, had already, and this court in Ross rejected the notion that what are ethical disciplinary rules should somehow trump the higher value of a court system that embraces the appearance of impropriety. So those rules, they haven't changed since Ross. They actually preceded Ross because that was the basis of the Ross dissent, is that the disciplinary rules authorize the sort of screening that the state is saying is sufficient. And I think what you have to look at is all that has transpired in this case, including the screening, and whether or not there's an appearance of impropriety. And I think on the facts presented here as to her degree of involvement, this attorney, and also when you look at the kinds of commentary that she memorialized in writing about this client's family, about the merits of the client's case, it would cause a person to question the fairness of the proceedings.
Is there anything that they could have done after, you know, they hired her that would have prevented the argument you're making? Was there any defect in their wall or the way they did it? Anything they could have done that correct your
problem?
I'm
not saying that there was a defect in her wall. What I'm saying is that on all the facts that we have here,
right.
The wall,
so my question
enough.
Is there anything they could have done that would have satisfied the argument you're making?
I think on the facts that we have here, there's not anything else. But that should not be the test whether she has been walled off enough. I think what the state has argued for is a per se rule. We wall off, the attorney comes in and says, I didn't share any information, that ends the inquiry. I think you have to look at all the facts. And I don't think you can just sort of narrowly focus on what are the ethical disciplinary rules, because this is not a disciplinary case, and those rules should be reserved for a disciplinary situation.
Is there a specific rule on the Chinese wall? Is there a rule on how you set it up and how you ensure, or what size office can have a Chinese wall? For example, St. Louis County's prosecutor's office probably has 40 attorneys. I mean, you could probably set something up there. But if a firm, how many lawyers in Newton?
My understanding is that there are 4 to 5 prosecutors in that county, and that is the same as took place in the Stay Extra Horn versus Ray case. It was a county of similar size, and in that case, the prosecutor's office consented to and disqualified itself on all the cases in which that attorney had been a public defender and then became a prosecutor. So I think it's really greatly overstated by the state in terms of the burden that's imposed upon them, both in terms of cost and also employment opportunities, because this person could have gone to a different prosecutor's office. This issue wouldn't have arisen.
What if she had gone to the AG's office? Is your argument that would disqualify everyone at the AG's office?
I don't see why it would disqualify everyone in the AG's office, no.
How's that the difference?
The AG's office isn't on the case. At what point are you saying?
If the AG's office was involved in the case, such as handling an appeal, if she went to the AG's office, your argument would seemingly apply as equally to that circumstance as it would a prosecutor's office.
I think we would have to look at the facts on appeal when we got there, because I think we're taking it a step removed from the trial court in terms of the facts that existed.
But the rationale for it is the appearance of impropriety and your client's concern that there's an opportunity to share information. So even if it was the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office with many employees, or the AG's office with even more employees, wouldn't that same rationale apply?
I think it's somewhat removed because you've now proceeded to the appellate process, and there also has been a party that is viewed as neutral, and that's why they're being assigned as a special prosecutor.
The reason I ask is because in the AG's office, we had the AG's office representing both sides of the same case. And so clearly we recognize that a governmental attorney's office can handle conflict circumstances within the same office and not have the appearance of impropriety or disqualification.
I think in the situation of the AG's office, I don't know that it necessarily it would necessarily disqualify them. I mean, I think we would have to look at, you know, at some point there may be a possibility where the confining off or cordoning off of her might be sufficient.
And that's my question. Why not? Why does your rationale, would it allow that, but not the...
Because I think the trial court is very different. There's been these communications that have gone on with the client and all, whereas I don't think you're going to have those kinds of communications with the AG's office is not going to have had those kinds of communications with the client.
Well, are you saying this because of the size? I mean, what if it's a large prosecutor's office? You know, the AG's office is very large. I mean, are you making the delineation because of the size? I mean, what if it's the same facts? This woman was joining the AG's office as opposed to a small law firm or small
or
prosecutor's
Jackson
office.
Jackson County instead of the AG's office.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
A big county like Jackson County, if
right.
She'd been in Jackson County. So it's still trial level.
But if she goes to Jackson County, she's not up against her former opponent.
If the case was in, if this whole thing happened to Jackson County.
Okay. Is part of your argument that it's a small prosecutor's office with, say, three or four attorneys, and therefore the Chinese wall may not be effective, whereas if she had been a public defender in Kansas City and then switched to the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office, where there's maybe 30 prosecutors, that the Chinese wall would be more effective? Or are you saying all the prosecutors in Jackson County would have to be recused the same way, have to be disqualified? That's the question.
I think you have to look at each individual case, and the size matters. I mean, this case law that talks about
it seems to me you've changed your argument because you were suggesting it's the appearance goes to what's in the mind of the defendant. The mind of the defendant doesn't trust an office of 50 any more than it trusts an office of 5, does it?
I think that's a part of the weighing process that would go on in the trial court.
In this case, the trial judge found that the Chinese wall was effective, that she didn't have any contact.
And I think the trial judge is wrong when you look at all the facts and when you look at her memoranda and the things that
was it an abuse of discretion standard, or is it another standard?
I'm sorry.
Does the trial judge have to abuse discretion for it to be reviewed by us? Or?
That is the standard of review, abuse of discretion, yes.
If we were to hold there was a potential conflict here, an appearance of impropriety, how would that affect the fact that I believe I'm correct that the public defender has a separate post-conviction office that handles post-conviction claims where you claim trial counsel was ineffective, and so they have a separate office handling that so that because otherwise you're trying to argue your colleague down the hall was ineffective, and that's sort of a Chinese wall on purpose in order to separate those two functions and avoid that conflict of interest. But would that be ineffective now if we were to adopt your argument? Because
public defender situation is different because this court has directed the public defender.
But in terms of appearance of impropriety, does it have the same appearance?
I don't think it has the same appearance, no. It does not, because those are separate offices and they've been established as separate offices for those reasons.
Now, what if every prosecutor is separately elected by their constituents? So what if it's one prosecutor's office? It would seem simple enough to move it to the other. But if it's a marijuana charge, and one jurisdiction says, you know, it's less than an ounce, we're not going to really pursue it. Prosecutorial, or the first one says, we're going to pursue it, but the second one, the neighboring county says, you know, we're not going to pursue it. It's just we have other resources we want to put in other things. What happens then if we were to say, well, the next prosecutor over can handle it? Can that prosecutor, which Judge Fisher said, can they say, no, we decline, we don't want to do it?
I'm not seeing the conflict.
Well, if the prosecutor doesn't want to do it, I mean, you have a prosecution in one county, and the public defender is going to that prosecutor's office, and they're going to say, well, we don't want her to change jobs, but shift the prosecution to another county, and that other county says, that's not in our priorities. That's not what we do. That's not what we prosecute.
Are you saying that the other county that it's been shifted to, declines to prosecute?
Yes.
I mean, I think the court has authority to appoint someone that will proceed onward with the case, and I think that would be left.
Or should it be the court or the attorney general?
You said there are procedures in the attorney general. Available to, because by statute that the attorney general could be appointed to represent. I mean, that's one option, but the court also could appoint other prosecutors. But then I think the case is in the hand of the prosecutor that's been designated as to how it's handled.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have some time on rebuttal.
Now, do you have a set rule for Chinese walls? I mean, this comes up, as you've indicated a number of times. Do you have a rule in the prosecutor's office that this is how these cases should be handled? No contact from investigators, no blah, blah, blah. Do you set out whenever this occurs?
The rules of professional conduct define what screening is, but the rules themselves don't say what is and what is not effective screening. Obviously, prosecutors' offices would need to come up with those rules themselves, depending on the size of the office, as counsel indicated, and depending on the specific facts of the case. And that's something that the trial judge can investigate at a hearing, as the trial judge did in this case, and as Judge Fisher indicated, found the screening procedures to be effective. So you're correct that prosecutors' offices would need to have their own procedures, and those would need to be looked at on a case-by-case basis.
Opposing counsel notes that Russ said an appearance of impropriety is sufficient, and that's been the law for a long time, and we haven't had refusals of prosecutors to hire public defenders. And the parade of horribles hasn't occurred. Why do you think it would occur were this court to adopt opposing counsel's view?
Well, first of all, opposing counsel asks that the appearance of impropriety standard be completely divorced from the rules. That was not what Ross held. Ross found that there was a violation of 4-1.11, and that was the basis for the appearance of impropriety. And so if we were to say that things like writing internal memoranda creates an appearance of impropriety, that's never been held before.
Does it have to be a violation of the ethics rules to be an appearance of impropriety? Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, because if not, we're not giving attorneys notice of what is improper and what is not improper. The purpose of the rules is to put attorneys on notice of what
is. Well, judges recuse for an appearance of impropriety and nothing spells out what that is, but judges really don't have a problem with figuring it out.
That's because, obviously, the code says that they should. The rules do not.
But it's not that it specifies what an appearance is. It says if you're saying we couldn't know what an, you're saying no one and lawyer would not know what an appearance of impropriety was if it wasn't set out in the rule. And I'm saying, but judges can figure out for themselves what constitutes.
Is that your argument? What Judge Stitt just said? I understood your argument to be that the rules don't require disqualification when there's an appearance of propriety.
And absolutely, I agree that's your argument. But my question was, should that be the dispositive question, whether the rules require a disqualification for an appearance of impropriety for disciplinary purposes and deciding whether in a particular case there is an appearance of impropriety? Because we say that disciplinary rules are normally not admissible in cases as evidence of appropriate conduct, therefore discipline cases. So, but clearly they have some relevance here, and I'm just wondering if that's the only thing that's relevant, or do you actually look at the conduct, too, and make a factual decision?
So the state is arguing both that since the rules do not say appearance of impropriety, that it should not continue to be applied. But if this court chooses to apply it, then it should be based on the rules, because doing otherwise would not give attorneys fair notice.
What if our case says an appearance of impropriety is a reason, then that's fair notice?
It could be, but that has not been what the court has held.
For example, I'm asking you if there would be problems with that. Can you go on and explain further why you think we shouldn't do that?
Yes, for the same reasons that this court said in its commentary to the rules, that the appearance of impropriety is vague and unworkable.
And I'm saying it's not for judges. Judges apply it all the time to themselves, so why is it not vague and unworkable for judges, but it is vague and unworkable for lawyers?
I think that first of all, the fact that we're imputing disqualification makes a difference. But second of all, it's simply different because this court has said that it's vague and unworkable for lawyers and not for judges. And so I think that that's a good enough reason.
So well, the, certainly if the standard was appearance of impropriety, it certainly wouldn't be limited to allegations of conflict or potential conflict.
Correct.
Any defendant could allege any reason they wanted to as to why a prosecutor shouldn't stay on the case.
If we were completely divorced from the rules, yes. As this defendant is doing now, stating that internal memoranda create an appearance of impropriety. And that is not a road that we should go down. So in the original comments to Rule 4-1.10, it talked about the competing interests that led to the current...
So if the internal memorandum are client confidences, how would the... And the appearance of impropriety, I assume that's to appear to be improper to the judge, not to the defendant. Is that correct?
Generally, the appearance of impropriety standard is to a reasonably well-informed observer.
To who?
To a reasonably well-informed observer. To the reasonable person. And, for example, with judges, the standard is whether a reasonable person would have factual grounds to doubt the impartiality of the court. So you're correct that the judge is the one analyzing it, but it is a reasonable person basis. And no internal memoranda should not be the basis for such a final.
How important is it to our system that there be public trust and confidence in the fairness of the system?
It is important.
And so how do we honor that where we do have a prosecutor's office, it's a very small office, we do have a public defender who made some inappropriate comments showing kind of disdain for her client. Do those factors change the analysis when you have an objective test?
No. First of all, the fact that the attorney didn't like her client may be a basis to disqualify her from representing that client, but it's not a reason to disqualify an entire prosecutor's office. I can't conceive of a situation where an entire prosecutor's office would like a defendant and that would be a requirement for the prosecutor to proceed on a case. And the comments to Rule 4-1.10 discussed the interest. First was the protecting the ideals of loyalty to former clients. And that had to be weighed against allowing a client to hire their desired counsel and in not creating unreasonable barriers to the legal market. And the comments state that the two approaches they could take were the appearance of impropriety standard under the canons or the current disqualification and conflict standards that are in the rules now. And this court chose to adopt the disqualification and conflict standards rather than the appearance of impropriety standard. It's true, in Ross, this court continued to apply the appearance of impropriety standard. It did so based on rules, cases that preceded the adoption of the rules, cases like Croca.
And so isn't that an indication it didn't believe the rules changed the standard, as you're arguing?
Ross is contrary to my first argument, yes. But when Ross was decided, they did find an ethical violation based on the rules. And in cases since then that have found ethical violations, cases like, for example, State X. Rel. Burns v. Richards, 248 Southwest 3rd, 603, they found that a prosecutor should be disqualified because of his prior representation. And that was based on his conflict as described in the rules. And that is the standard that should, if we choose to apply the appearance of impropriety, should continue to be applied.
Is there a dichotomy between the ethical rule and the judicial determination?
I'm sorry?
Is there a dichotomy between the ethical rule and the judicial determination regarding the appearance of impropriety? So you might not violate the ethics rule, but still the judge might say, you know, it doesn't look good. We should do something different.
That has not been this court's holding. That was not the holding in Ross. And as I've argued, I don't believe that doing so would give attorneys fair notice.
So what if this court were to hold, and this is totally hypothetical, that there was an appearance of impropriety here? You would have a say, but the rule doesn't say, the disciplinary rules don't say an appearance of impropriety. It's a violation of the ethical rules to not disqualify yourself where there's an appearance of impropriety. So it's okay. I mean, yeah. I'm unclear if you're saying even if this court finds there's an appearance of impropriety, it's still not a reason to disqualify?
Yes, I am.
So we could make a finding, yes, it appears improper, but
yes.
Stay on nonetheless.
Yes.
Why is that good policy?
Because the disqualification should be based on the reasons described in the rules. The reasons.
Why? We're not dealing with discipline. We're dealing with a fair trial and the appearance of impropriety to a reasonable person watching the trial. Would someone feel like it's an impartial prosecutor, an impartial judge, an impartial process? Why is that the same question as whether an attorney should be disciplined for their conduct?
The reasons, as set forth in my brief, are first the barriers to the legal market, which was the reason why this court did not adopt the appearance of impropriety in the rules. The second is that this is simply a cosmetic concern. If there's no actual impropriety, and we're basing this on the mere appearance of impropriety, then that is not...
It's not a cosmetic concern. That's a concern about that people will not trust the system, which is not cosmetic.
If their concern is based on an actual impropriety, then that's a valid basis. If it's based purely on what appears to be improper, after a factual finding that the person has been screened and things like that, then that's an unreasonable basis.
Does it make a difference? As a matter of policy, does it make a difference whether this standard should apply to judicial officers as opposed to prosecutors? I mean, most defendants don't base their belief on the fairness of the system based upon their opinion of the advocate against them, like they do a judge being a detached and neutral magistrate.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
I mean,
and
not often do we have defendants necessarily think the prosecutors are fair.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And this is not a case where the conflicted attorney was prosecuting the defendant, because that's contrary to the rules. This was a case where it was merely someone else that worked with the conflicted attorney. And of course, judges are not, we do not impute conflicts across the bench. One judge's conflict is not imputed to another, even though the appearance of impropriety standard is the one that applies. Even in the most extreme cases, like the case of Napoleon Beasley, when three U.S. Supreme Court justices had to be recused because of a personal conflict, that was not imputed to anyone else.
And in fact, in the Smalls case, we specifically held that the entire circuit is not disqualified of particular judges. Only that judge is disqualified.
Correct. And that's so even if under the even if the code, the judicial canon were to be applied, imputing conflicts is contrary to the rules and is contrary to the application of the judicial canons.
So if you could rewrite the Southern District's opinion, how would you have rewritten it? Or how would you rewrite it?
I would not.
You follow their analysis completely?
I think it is fine. I don't recall any where that I thought that they were incorrect. I think that this case, it can be distinguished from Ross. However, I think that this is an opportunity for the court to revisit an incorrect decision. So I agree that there is this can be distinguished from Ross based on the fact that this is conflicts with former clients, not concurrent representation, the fact that there was screening as opposed to no screening in Ross.
Does it have to be all or nothing? I mean, can we read the rule to say that it is not an appearance of impropriety to hire a former public defender if they're properly screened?
Yes, and that is what many other jurisdictions have held. They have continued to apply the appearance of impropriety standard, but have held that in certain circumstances, when there's a factual determination.
Like a safe harbor. If you screen off the new employee, then that is not an appearance of impropriety.
Yes, that's what many other jurisdictions have held. And in the comments to Rule 4-1.11, they state that although conflicts are not imputed to government attorneys, it says that it would be prudent to screen such attorneys. Defendant's argument would have us read out both sections, both that conflicts are not imputed and that it would be prudent to screen such attorneys. Because defendant's request, defendant recognizes that his remedy is a cosmetic one, the appointment of a special prosecutor when communication between the prosecuting attorney that apparently is conflicted now and the special prosecutor, that communication must take place, but it appears more proper to appoint a special prosecutor. But if all we're looking for is a cosmetic remedy that demonstrates the state's commitment to a fair and impartial decision by the prosecutor, then screening should be that decision. First, it does not create the unreasonable barriers to the legal market that the amicus writes about. Second, it allows the people to have their choice of prosecutor. These are the people who have elected their prosecutor. This is their choice of who should represent them in criminal cases. And this allows that to continue to take place by simply screening one attorney. And second, it does maintain the defendant's right to a fair trial. The person who made all the decisions in this case did not speak with Cheney. He did not base his decisions on information from her. And frankly, the information, although defendant talks about how long they talked about the medical conditions, on cross-examination, the state asked the defendant, what does this have to do with your case? And his answer was nothing. Although he later walked it back and said, well, this diminished my libido, it did this. He credited that far more to his diabetes than to his heart condition. And in simple fact, his heart condition had nothing to do with the case. And so the fact that she didn't particularly like the defendant and the fact that she knew about his heart condition, a condition which was not confidential information, neither of those facts created an appearance of impropriety. For these reasons, I would ask that the trial court's, the defendant's sentence and conviction be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, I'd like to go back to Judge Breckenridge's question about the AG's office. I think it's sort of analogous to what Judge Stiff brought up. If the attorney had gone to the AG's criminal division, then yes, the AG's criminal division would not be allowed to represent the state on appeal. But another division, like the public defenders on post-conviction, within the AG's office would be allowed to represent the state. I think the criminal division would not be allowed to represent the state in that circumstance, but it wouldn't disqualify the entire
office. Why does the wall work?
I'm sorry.
Why does the wall work for somebody in the same building with the same title in a different division, but it doesn't work for somebody in the same division?
That's what this court has endorsed as the public defender's office in its post-conviction. And I would say the same would apply in these circumstances if it was the AG's office.
It's sounding like if that's the distinction, that basically there's less reason, you have less faith in the effectiveness of a Chinese wall if people are constantly interacting during work. Is that the difference? It doesn't appear adequate, or because otherwise there wouldn't really be much distinction.
I think the Chinese wall is one factor that gets into the entire weighing process. It's not the only factor, and I think that's what the state is saying. You know, we did the walling, she testified, I didn't disclose anything, end of inquiry. Well, that's not the end of the inquiry. There's these other factors of things that she did, disparaging memos that she wrote, and what does that instill confidence in the defendant and the public at large who are viewing the overall proceedings?
And those are wouldn't instill confidence in her, but how does that affect whether or not the prosecutor has a conflict or an appearance of impropriety?
Well, I think if she's gone to work for the opposition and that prosecutor is prosecuting the defendant, it certainly, I think, as a defendant and the public at large, it creates the appearance of, wow, this person is on the same side, that they just switch sides and all. It is about the appearance. It's really not about whether the adequacy of the walling that took place was adequate or not. It's about the actual appearance.
Right. So there is no wall that would satisfy you.
No, I'm not saying that.
Well, that is what you just said.
No, I'm saying that the walling is part of the overall inquiry. Just like when we look at judges, we look at everything that took place as to whether or not we disqualify them.
You're saying the wall in and of itself is only part of the inquiry.
Absolutely.
You look beyond that to see if there's other reasons to see if there's it's an important part of it, but it may not be sufficient in all circumstances.
That's exactly right. It's one piece of the overall inquiry. Just like in Anderson, we looked at different things that were said and done by the judge. We didn't look at one item. We looked at the entire thing that took place. And it wasn't like, and the court went to great lengths to say, it's not that we disbelieve the judge or the judge is lacking integrity. In fact, they have a presumption of integrity. But we still disqualify. And it's the same sort of considerations here. I would like to address Judge Fish's concern about, defendants look to how judges behave, but they also look to how prosecutors behave, and that's why we, in Ross, talked about the quasi-judicial nature of a prosecutor, that both are looked to in terms of the fairness of the proceedings. It's not just the judge, but it is the prosecutor, and they both have that function. That's what Ross is about. In Ross, the ethical violation that was found was in the failure of the private law firm to disclose to the defendant what they were doing. It wasn't about the criminal prosecution itself. It was that they should have put him on notice that they had people who were prosecutors and who were representing him, defending him on the civil action. So it had nothing to do with the criminal action. So that's how the ethical rules came into play there. They had nothing to do with the disqualification issue.
Are there any further questions?
Thank you. I'd ask the court to reverse Mr. Lamas's conviction. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The matter will be taken as submitted. Mr.